hi, I'm the pot. No. What did I say last time?
I think you said welcome to the Unstable Fluid podcast, where I'm unstable and he's the fluid.
That's it.
Not just I'm the podcast.
I'm doing my best. Hi, welcome to the Unstable Fluid podcast, where I'm the pot and he's the cast.
I'm not sure if that's worse than the last one.
I like it. I think. Yeah, I'm gonna keep doing these. Just deal with it.
Okay.
You let
cool.
me do this on a microphone. This is what you get. I'm Kat. He's Thomas, and we're here to talk about PhDs and stuff.
Yeah, and actually, for you introduced us this time, which we didn't do in the last episode. I did realize.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not your fault. I forgot as well. But yeah, yeah. It's odd doing a podcast recording so soon after the last one.
I know. Is this what professionals feel like? Because it's strange.
I don't know. We did just have a complete like 30 seconds of corpsing at the start there, so I don't know.
I think that's definitely part of the promo. Honestly, the Unstable Fluid podcast bloopers are going to be incredible.
Yeah,
in
I should really start
somewhere.
Like saving them.
Anyway, how are you doing, Thomas?
I'm good. I am slightly stressed, but that's just because I'm at a conference next week for the first time, and that is scary. But otherwise, I'm good. Bit tired, but you know, goes with the territory.
That's good.
How
I mean,
you?
Like, is slightly stressed more than average for a PhD, or like, you know, I feel like slightly stressed is just kind of the next 3 years of your life.
Yeah, I think at the minute it's slightly above, well, at least my average, if not everyone else's average, but that's mostly because with the first conference, I'm having to sort out posters and how that gets printed and how you do that with international travel. And yeah, but it's fine. I think it's sorted. I can't do anything for another 2 days when the poster should be getting delivered to me.
My advice is just don't look at it, because if you see a typo, you're going to be sad. And at this point, just write it out. I've done that. I have a typo on every single poster I've ever presented. And, you know, we're not perfect. I'm sure other people do as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's only you that knows it. So as long as there's like no glaring mistakes, you're fine.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I have my master's project poster actually on the wall, like over there, and I've only just noticed today, bearing in mind that I presented this thing at least 8 months ago, I've only just noticed today that the axis labels for one of the graphs overlaps with the like tick labels, so the values. I've only just noticed that today. Which is
fine. Well, no one else commented on it, so it's fine.
No one's commented on it to my face, and it'll get replaced with a new poster in the next couple of weeks, so that's fine.
Very exciting. You're not going to start building up a wall of posters? Are they got this one on top of the other, or is this a...
I think I might run out of wall.
Depends how many posters you present.
Yeah.
You're quite cute. You could start printing them smaller, and then like have posterception as the more posters you get. It's still A0 sized, but you just have like loads of them stacked up. That would be quite cute.
Or just have like a little,
I don't want to do that.
Like a picture of the previous poster in each subsequent poster. It just gets many, many posters deep.
I know someone that actually does that. She takes a photo of like a selfie of her and her poster that sits in the top corner of every poster. And I think there were like 5 or 6 posters deep when I saw it. So I don't know what the original one, if there's like just a picture of her on the first one, or if she managed to somehow like selfie herself into that poster. That would be really cool.
Yes.
If you could Photoshop it so that you were stood in front of the poster that you're stood in front of.
Yeah, I mean, that's doable. Because especially if you make the copy of it in it small enough that you can't see what's in the top left corner, then...
Yeah. But just like vaguely the right colours.
Yeah.
Definitely not a good way to procrastinate actually putting your research on a poster at all.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Anyway, how are you, Kat?
I'm doing good, thank you. In a surprise to possibly everyone that knows me. I am officially in the writing up B bit of work. I can't keep pretending that I'm going to start writing soon. I am officially writing up the thesis. And it's been going pleasantly.
That was a very considered word.
Well, I don't think it's hit me that I should be stressed yet. Like I've been stressed leading up to writing up, because this is the, you know, the finishing line is in sight, but then I'm just at the start of it, so I'm still just taking it as one day at a time, and I'm feeling very calm about things, and at some point it's going to hit me, but it hasn't yet. So I'm just enjoying going back over, you know, work I did 2-3 years ago, and writing all of that up, because it's all nice fun stuff.
That's good. So it's sort of revisiting the various projects and such that you've done throughout, or has it all been kind of one long continuous thing?
So my work is one long continuous thing, but my final model is using 3 or 4 different like key concepts of fluid dynamics. So what I'm doing at the minute is writing up the introduction, and that is kind of the way that I want to introduce the bigger model, is by introducing all these little concepts of fluid dynamics. So I'm writing these really short, nice inserts into kind of key concepts, like kind of like a what you would see in a lecture, right? Or a textbook. It's like, here's a nice concept, here's like a little toy example. And yeah, it's reminding me of my undergrad and, you know, first year PhD, when I was all, everything was new and exciting, and it's quite fun.
As opposed to now, where you're just jaded.
As opposed to now, where I'm jaded. Yeah, but, you know, I'm really happy with my final model, as I'm still working on it, and it's a really cool thing. But being able to go back and explain the basics in my own words and see, you know, when you introduce the Navier-Stokes equations, for example, like the big governing equations of fluid dynamics, I'm writing it in the way that I see it in a textbook, and like how I saw it in lectures and how I was introduced to it. And to read something that introduces this like fundamental concept to my life, but I wrote that, feels really cool.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's good. We're leaving that question behind, but like it's, I'm so far proud of what I'm doing, and that's, I'm trying to keep riding that high. I'll eventually, you know, crash, but for right now I'm happy with things.
I mean, I think we will talk more about this later, but just for people that sort of aren't aware of how a thesis is kind of structured, it is, as far as I'm understanding it, you kind of start fairly broad, you introduce the area that you're working in, you slowly funnel people down to the very specific bit of, well, in your case, maths, that you're actually that you've actually spent the last 4 years doing.
Yeah, so I think it's a very personal thing. So every single person's thesis, even on very similar topics, is going to be quite different, and how you go about it. The main point of a thesis is to present novel work, right? To do a PhD, you have to have done significant research and like made a little dent in your field. I think you described it in the pilot as like, if the big bubble, you just like make a little dent.
Yeah, the sphere of all knowledge, and you sort of push out a little bit.
Yeah, that was it. I like that explanation. The thesis is like, you're proving that A, it was you that did the work, that you can explain it, that you understand it, and also what it is. Some people, that does look like, you know, almost textbook-esque style of, here's the introduction of the sort of areas, and then you're building it up and you get to like maybe some result. For some people, it might be, if they've worked on a few different projects, you might have a lot of little sections like that, that are spaced out rather than like one big build-up. And then some people do what's called thesis by publication. So it varies from field to field on how common it is and like how it's structured. But loosely, if you have published a paper during your PhD, you can do what's called thesis by publication, which is, you have to fill out a little form at the start, but maybe as one of your chapters or even as your whole thing, you just insert your paper. So you would have to write a bit of an introduction saying, in this paper, this is the amount of work that I did versus collaborators. But you can just like slip it in as either a chapter or as kind of a core concept, depending on how big it is, how novel it is, how much of it describes your research.
Yeah, I think I remember my my master's project supervisor saying that when he did his PhD, his thesis was essentially 3 papers stapled together.
Yeah, and it's becoming, I think, more common to do that. So I can't remember what the other way is called, just like thesis by thesis. But yeah, it's, as more and more people are publishing during their PhD, that is a nice way to do it, because then you don't have to rewrite everything that you wrote in the paper. That being said, some people decide not to do that, even if they do have publications, because they might want the thesis to flow through a bit more.
It definitely is not the sort of thing that works for, say, a PhD like yours, where you've done 4 years of the actual main topic of your thesis, and it's one long thing. Whereas,
yeah,
what's very common, at least in, I was going to say in physics, but at least in astronomy, is that people will do essentially a thesis by publication, but they're not allowed to staple everything together in some cases. Like, my department doesn't allow it, as far as I'm aware. So you do your various projects, and each project that may have produced a paper then makes up one major chapter of your thesis.
Yeah.
And that seems to be fairly common within astronomy, and I think within other areas of the physical sciences. We've talked a lot already about me doing poster things, you doing thesis things. Shall we maybe introduce the actual topic for today's episode of the podcast, which is meant to be sort of academic writing and reading, and basically all the written stuff around academia, how we do words good. He says doing words very bad.
We don't let Thomas talk, apparently. That's how we do words good.
Oh, there is one of the major astronomy YouTubers, Dr. Becky Smethurst from the University of Oxford, and she has like merch that just says on it, "Space is hard, words are harder." And I relate very much so.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's the bane of, I'd say, probably a good percentage of STEM students' existence is having to write stuff up. I know I absolutely loathe it. I'm getting more comfortable with it, but it's always the thing that, you know, doing the research is really fun and exciting, and I like playing with the numbers and the coding, and you know, you get the pretty pictures, and then it's like, right, write about it. And that's always really hard.
Yeah, I think a lot of us went into the sciences in the first place in school because we didn't like doing a lot of the stuff that you have to do in the humanities. A lot of that being reading and writing. At least reading critically as opposed to enjoying books, because plenty of scientists like that. But I think that's the problem, is that a lot of us came into the sciences because we didn't want to write essays, and now we have to write up our work in a way that is understandable to other people. And that's a hard skill to learn.
Yeah, especially when you haven't done it for so long. I mean, even undergrad, there's not necessarily that much opportunity, I would say, in most of the... talking very maths focused now, I'm guessing you guys did reports in physics and stuff.
We had some lab reports, but again, if you're not in the experimental side, you're probably not going to have done that much writing up until you get to the final year projects.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we had one written thing in first year just to kind of be like, hey, look, this is something you can do, and then we all forgot about it until our final year. And it's, you know, it's a considerable amount of time where you're not practicing, for lack of a better term. Like, I do believe writing is a skill that is learnable, but yeah, when you go for an entire, you know, few years of your life without doing it, it's hard to pick it up again, especially when the alternative is go play with some code, and that's more fun.
Or so obviously procrastinate while that. Your code runs and you're technically working.
Don't tell them. You said the inside bit out loud.
Oh, sorry. I'll cut that out. No, it's definitely... It's one of those things that... It definitely falls under the realm of transferable skills, and they can be learned. But it's not as simple as make a PowerPoint presentation where you can follow fairly reasonable guidelines and create something, if not amazing, but certainly passable. Whereas when you're writing, it takes a while to find that sort of authorial voice, the style of writing that works for you. And I don't know, I feel like maybe I've had a bit more practice of at least finding that, because I've had to write plenty YouTube scripts and stuff. But it is then again different when you have to go do some academic writing, because I've been criticized every time I try and do any sort of academic writing of, you're being too verbose, be more succinct and just say the exact things, do not go so narrative style.
I was gonna say, so like the YouTube script writing is going to be a very different tone to the academic. I can see how that would kind of translate across, though, like the way that you present, because especially because you do science communication, like you're talking about science, and it kind of sneaks back into your academic stuff. I actually get this as well, where I get told that I'm not going as technical as I need to be. I tend to present very surface level, because I think a lot of what I do, spend my time doing is talking in this very like casual sort of relaxed format. And there's an entire sort of rabbit hole to go down of should formal language always be associated with sort of high intellect and that whole rabbit hole. But yeah, I get comments a lot of like, my tone is too informal. So it's kind of interesting that you get similar sort of, the science communication sneaking into academia is good because we explain things, but bad because we maybe don't do it in the way that people are expecting.
Yeah. Whereas at the same time, I do find that I think I find it much easier to structure academic writing in a way that is understandable to people because I've had to structure so many YouTube scripts in a way that makes sense. So that sense of being a slightly more narrative style makes the things I write academically more readable. But then the language within that structure is then a bit more informal and narrative and verbose than it should be. It's almost like I like the sound of my own voice.
That's interesting.
I said almost, I don't, but it's almost.
It's the fact that we do a podcast. Just every time, every single time. Like, yeah. You raise an interesting point, though, of like how to do writing good. And I think the advice that I get given and the advice that I do think works, I'm just stubborn about not using it, is the structuring, right? You kind of lay it out first, maybe bullet point, fill in sections. For us, it's like you either bullet point, you know, words in a paragraph, but you just put the equations in and kind of fill in the writing around it and be like, okay, how did you get from step A to step B? So do you find, that the way that you kind of set up a YouTube video helps with how you were like then comfortable setting up the academic writing?
I think so. There's a certain, so that I should maybe explain the way that I go around structuring a YouTube video script. And the inspiration for this, I don't know exactly where it's come from originally, but I got it by way of Dr. Simon Clark, because like many things science communication wise, I've talked to him a fair bit about things like this. And the structure, the way that I structure a video is that I will sort of bullet point it, like you said, of like pick out the main points. But then as far as working out how to structure the whole thing is take each key point and you have to be able to put in between each thing, but or therefore. This statement, but there is some stuff that could say this is disputed, or but what about this counterpoint, and explain things like that, and or say statement, therefore this thing is true. And you can work through, as long as you can put but or therefore between each thing, that I do find helps structure at least an explanation. So maybe not an entire paper or poster or talk, but at least each section of it has to be able to be linked in some way. Otherwise, all you have is what my second year English teacher described as a bus timetable. This happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. There's no explanation there.
It's just, you have a bus timetable, wrong and sometimes non-existent.
Theoretical physics.
I like that. I find that interesting as a concept. Because, I think sometimes when you're reading something and it is just very disjoint segments, it can feel really whiplashy, I guess. Like you feel like you're kind of being dragged around and you can't see through it. So I like that plan, the continuation.
I think it's a good way to organize your thoughts on a topic as well, because if you're like working, say, with some specific phenomenon, like to bounce off last episode, RAM pressure, if you're going to explain the topic, explain the phenomenon, and then go and talk about six or seven other things, and then get to the bit where you say, and this is why the RAM pressure thing I explained about 17 paragraphs earlier was important. Your reader's trying to go from the first paragraph to about the 20th paragraph and back and forth, and you're jumping all over the paper. Whereas if there's some explanation of why it's important, even if it's not getting to your actual results until later, it sort of reduces that feeling of whiplash.
I've never heard it said so succinctly as that, but the thing that I get caught up on a lot by my supervisor is I will write things chronologically for me, which isn't always the best way to write things for someone who's new to a topic, right? Like, when you're doing research, it's not linear. It's not, you don't do things in the optimal way through. And I have this awful habit of how I was introduced to something is how I then perceive it. So that's how it lives in my brain, and that's how I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Whereas actually maybe the bit that I did last would make more sense sooner, because it then has that flow through of sort of when you're reading something, and if you have perfect knowledge and you want to introduce someone to a topic, having it in this way, as you say, that it makes sense and it connects, and I'm not having to think from make giant leaps between ideas. It's all very nicely laid out. But yeah, when you're doing it, when you've been staring at this thing for 2 months, 6 months, 4 years, it's hard to distinguish sort of how you were introduced to that topic to how it should really be written.
Beyond just the that sort of linking structure within a paper or within a bit of writing, whatever it is, I think the other thing that I've heard quite a lot of people in academia doing is what can be described as like the teacher's method.
Okay.
Of saying, this is what I'm going to tell you, telling you the thing, and this is what I have told you. And it works really well in talks, but I've also seen it as essentially is the structure of a paper.
Yeah.
The abstract and introduction, this is what I'm going to say. Methods, results, discussion, this is all of this. This is what I'm telling you. Get to the conclusion. This is what I have told you in the last 8 pages.
Yeah. It's a really nice thing to do between sections, because you kind of... So I think we will at some point switch to like reading academic writing rather than just writing about it. But when you read something, I know I just said it's nice to write things in a way that it's nice step by step. People don't read papers linearly.
No, they don't.
So having at the start and end of each section a little recap of what you've done or what's about to happen means that when someone is just flicking through, they don't have to like go scouring through everything to find it. You can just be like, all right, in this section, we're going to discuss the numerical methods or efficiency or the results. And yeah, it's a really nice...
I read
a
review paper that did this, and it was the easiest review paper to read because it was like a 60-page review paper.
Oh.
It was really long, but it was covering basically an entire topic.
Yeah.
And I was like, right, actually, all I need is on pages 34 to 38. And those sections kind of existed as their own thing because they said, this stuff is in section 2.4, this stuff will be discussed later in 4.8. And
yeah, so signposting, as you say, it's actually something that I got commented on when I was giving my first sort of in-person talk, was like, it's a really, really, really good thing to do. And if you can bring that in as early as possible with your communication in academic writing or anything really, it's going to help people catch up and follow along a lot easier. I always like it when I see that in a paper.
Speaking of that, shall we talk about reading?
Yeah, what are you reading at the minute?
At the minute, I've been rereading my own poster, but non-academically, Lord of the Rings. Okay. Academically, not enough.
That's fair. Have you read Lord of the Rings before?
No, this is my first time through it.
How are you finding it?
I really like Tolkien's world building. I found Fellowship very slow. I'm finding the Two Towers better paced so far. But I'm not very far in. I'm only about 10 to 15% of the way through.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but it's on my list. And I'm slowly learning.
Mm.
The perception I had of it when I was a kid of like, oh, it's too big of a book to read. I'm like, I read big fantasy. I read The Wheel of Time for crying out loud. I can handle Lord of the Rings. But
that's,
I'm like,
on my
is
list.
It worth doing? I'm currently reading a really good sci-fi book called Fools, and the narrative shift doesn't necessarily correspond with like potentially a character shift, and it's all this like mind-bending world building. It's incredible. But yeah, academic writing. Sorry, segue.
Academic reading.
Academic reading. Oh, the other thing. Okay, where would you like to start? My opinions on it, or how to do it?
I think we should probably talk about how to read, where to find papers, that sort of thing. And then we'll get to our opinions later.
That's fair enough. Yeah, so I guess like when people are starting out kind of fresh with research, the most academic writing that they will have seen up to that point, I guess, would be textbooks and like lecture notes.
I think so, yeah.
Fair to say. So the kind of main shift into research that people have, or that people will experience, is like textbooks tend to be written once something is pretty uniformly agreed upon. I'm sure there are some controversial textbooks out there, but typically it's sort of very well-established things in the field, which means they tend not to be sort of at the forefront of research. So the shift then is like, right, okay, when you start doing research, I think sometimes people have this perception that it's like, right, I sit in a room and I think about something really hard and then I just do it. And that's not always the case, because you're not the only person in the world working right at the front of what's new. So the way that we all kind of share our work is through publishing papers. That is the point of them, is like, hey guys, I did a thing. Look, like, you know, when you're in a room and I'm sure other people don't do this. I'm just like, you know, when you're in a room and you solve a puzzle and you're like, hey, come look at the thing I did, and you like share it. That a thing?
You're describing social media, but okay.
Yeah, basically. When people post that they've done something novel on like social media, it's basically the equivalent of someone publishing a paper in academia and going, hey, look,
yeah,
this thing I did, isn't it cool? And then people might fight about it, or people might be like, wow, that is cool.
It's saying, I have done this thing. Someone else has, not really, someone else has had a look at this and agrees that it is not raving lunacy. And... And then I have published it to the wider community to read and to criticize and to comment on and to tell me that I'm wrong, or say, no, I agree with this, my results support it.
So it's typically, when you're just starting out with research, the best like thing to do is get a good idea of what's already been done right at the front of the knowledge in your field. And that means reading a load of papers. I'm sure you're going through this right now, but every PhD that I know...
I have been going through this for the past few months.
...is actively encouraged to kind of review the literature in your field. There's a wide range of quality and a wide range of sort of depth and intensity of different papers and styles of papers. Mm-hmm. It's a really good thing, going sort of briefly back to even writing, is if you read a load of stuff in the field, you get the sense of sort of how people talk about your area. Let's say your supervisor has sent you a paper and said, hey, this looks interesting, and has just sent it over to you. Well, what do you do?
First thing I'm going to do is read the abstract and decide if I agree, because it's not always the case. Every academic reads down a list of new papers. Some people do it daily, most people do it at least once a week. A quick glance at the title and first few lines of an abstract can make it seem like this is really interesting, but a lot of the time it can actually not be as interesting as you think it's going to be. So that's the first thing I do, is read the abstract, which is kind of a 200 word synopsis at most, really, 200-250 words at most, synopsis of the paper, the research area, what they've done, and the headline result is going to be in the abstract. And if I read that and think that's interesting to me, then I'll open up the actual PDF of the paper and read more of it. Then I'll sort of read through the introduction. I might take a glance at the methods to see, just because I work in simulations, it's helpful to look in the methods section where they'll say, these are the simulations that we've used. And then I'll have a look at the key results. And by results, I mean the figures in the first instance. And if I'm still interested, then I'd probably read the vague conclusions and then read more in depth, go through the bits, the methods that I think are the most interesting, read through the results that I'm particularly interested in, because if I'm dealing with if it's one of these larger papers that's maybe on the sort of 20 page sort of length, then not everything in there is necessarily going to be interesting to me. They may be talking about several different things to do with these galaxies that they've simulated, and I might be interested in one of three things. But I'm not going to read it as abstract, introduction, methods, results, discussion, conclusion in that order. I am going to jump about.
Okay, yeah. That was kind of where my question was going. I find it interesting, though, sort of. I tend to read the introduction last.
It depends on the paper.
Yeah, very much so.
At this stage of my PhD, I'm still finding a lot of the papers I'm reading are on things I don't fully understand yet.
So
reading the introduction to get the context of them.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was doing my master's project, I'd read a lot of stuff on star formation up to that point already, and I spent a lot less time looking at the introductions.
I think that's reasonable. And the introductions, more often than not, again, this might be field specific, I'm not sure, tend to be where most of the citations are held for us.
Yeah.
So it will be a sort of brief overview of like, right, this work builds off these things, it's motivated by work done by these people. And it can go from there. I will read the abstract I will then jump straight to the first figure I can find. If it looks like it's doing something that is interesting to me, I will start to read the conclusion. And if that sounds like something that is relevant, I'll then jump to the equations, so like the method bit.
Yeah.
Typically, I read an introduction once I know that the paper is sort of relevant and I want to know more of like either a deeper dive into areas. So if they're saying they have this really nice method or this really nice concept and they've built off other work, I'll go like scouring through to see what it's built off and then go find those papers and start that sort of rabbit hole. Or just to see where it sort of fits in of like, oh, is this work that was done before or after them, or does it build, who does it build off, who is it adjacent to?
We do this every time. We go back in the process every time. But I'm going to jump to, how would you go about starting off that sort of literature review process of, I have no papers in front of me, I want to know about this thing. How do you find the papers to find out about that stuff?
Situationally, it's dependent. If you are working with a supervisor or a collaborator or a PI or whoever, if there's someone who has a better idea of the field than you, your first point of call is going to be to ask them for recommendations. So hopefully, if you're just starting a PhD, for example, or a master's project or a dissertation or whatever, your supervisor will be like, right, go read these three papers, say.
Yeah.
And that gives you a starting point. If you're doing independent research on your own and you're like, right, where do I go from here? If there are any known names in the field that you know of, go search them. I'm a big fan of Google Scholar.
I was going to say, because you were saying search for known names, but where do you search? Like just searching on general Google doesn't really work.
So Google has a separate search engine just for papers called Google Scholar. Yeah. If you can put some kind of keywords in there, it has quite an advanced filtering system. Typically, the links through that you will have potentially university access required, or that they'll link to the journal sites.
Yeah.
But people will tend to have a Google profile as well, so you can find specific academics through that, and that will then link all of their papers, and you can see them chronologically or by number of citations. And I think you can even search, like, I want to find the first paper that mentions bouncing droplets, so I'm going to limit my year of publishing at 1930 or something, and only search for old papers. So that's probably where I kind of go to as like my first point of call.
See, I don't use Google Scholar.
Okay. Well,
as my
you?
First point of call. I'm in a specific field. I'm in astrophysics, but this applies for physics as well, and possibly a little bit of maths, but I know it's less commonly used there. But there is a service called the NASA Astrophysical Data Service. And it has primarily astronomy papers, but there are a lot of physics papers there now as well. And it is essentially the go-to for everything in astronomy. You can search any keyword you want, any author you want, any year of publication, any journal. The filter system is really good. Links everything up. And crucially, links to the journals, but also to archive.
Hey, nice. I can't believe we made it an hour before we mentioned archive.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time talking about writing, so.
That's fair.
But yeah, so that is the main thing that the ADS has over Google Scholar, in my experience, is that you get an if the paper exists on archive, you get a link to it.
Amazing. Hey, Thomas, what's archive?
Archive is a service hosted by Cornell University in the US, and it's a preprint server. So authors, when they submit a paper to a journal to be published, whether it's Monthly Notices, the Royal Astronomical Society, or Astrophysical Journal, or something not in astronomy, Journal of Fluid Mechanics, I think was what you called it.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Any journal, though, you submit to the journal and you also post on archive. You put your paper there, and it's preprint at that point. So it's not been peer reviewed by another scientist. No one else has checked your work, but the paper is available for free to other people in the community, and people who have an interest in specific subject areas sign up for a daily email blast, or they can scroll through the website. So every morning when I sit down to work, I get an email from the archive system saying, here are all the papers in Astrophysics of Galaxies that have been published, well, have been posted on archive in the last 24 hours. And I can scroll through the titles, click links to whatever papers I think are interesting. Sometimes it's none, sometimes it's six. It depends on the day. And I can see what's going on in the field. And not every paper ends up on archive. Not every paper ends up on archive immediately. Some journals have like exclusivity periods. So if you're submitting to a certain journal, they'll say, well, you have to wait 6 months after this is accepted and published before you can put it on archive. Some will say, well, you can put it on archive once it's accepted, but not before that. And so there's some journals have certain rules about it, but most things are on archive. And actually, I'm finding that quite a lot of people in astronomy don't actually read directly from the journals in a lot of cases anymore, because the most thing, almost everything in astronomy is on archive, and like you don't have to deal with institutional login for one thing. You can just, because it's the same paper, give or take a couple of words most of the time.
I knew that the sort of motivation for it was, yeah, you have a version of your paper that is outside of the paywall system. But there's also the you know, from submission to publication can be months. And there's an element of like, if you want to show that you've done the work, or if you have, you know, it's a very competitive field and kind of almost want to kind of state your claim over your research, but just be like, hey, look, I have done this. It is completed. It's just in the works. Any archive was really good for that sort of thing. I mean, it's if you're looking for something specific and it's not on archive, there is like a realm of people who are just not that tech savvy or up that much with sort of their online, I was going to say socials, and it's not their socials, but it's their academic socials.
Yeah, I know like, what you mean. They're sort of
ORCID, Archive, Google Scholar. Like, so there are some people that don't keep up to date necessarily online.
Yeah.
There is a realm where if there is a specific paper and you know, look first, but if you can't find it, emailing the author and being like, hey, can I have a copy of this if you don't have institutional access? There are very few people I know that would say no to that question.
Yeah, there's no downside to the author to say, no, you've got to have access to your institution, because academics don't get paid for publishing papers. Most of the time, there are some places where they do, but there's generally institutions that produce lower quality papers because they produce more of them.
There's a whole realm of publishing politics, I would say, that exists.
That I'm not entirely sure we have time to get into today.
No, or the authority.
Nor would I feel qualified to make get a job. Many of those comments. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to do that thing where I think a lot of PhD students do this and be like, don't be like me when I was a first year. I didn't do...
Every PhD student does this.
I know, but you're already doing better than me, and hopefully everyone else will as well. But I did not do a big bulk of reading in my first year. I had sort of two or three papers that were kind of very, very core to what I was doing, and I focused a lot on those. And that was bad in a few ways. One, because I didn't really get a grasp of where that fit in the wider academic field. Was this like really, really novel? Is this like quite a well-established thing? I didn't have that good sense. There were similar co-authors on all three papers, which meant that the writing styles were very similar. So I wasn't exposed to a big breadth of, you know, types of papers, styles of papers, ways of describing things. And then the third one is like, when I then started going to conferences, it's quite bad to not know what other people are publishing in your field. Like, it's no one expects you to know everything. I think you're on an ego trip if you think everyone at a conference has read your paper. But when you're meeting someone, and I met this wonderful PhD student who actually does really, really similar stuff to me, but because it was shifted in sort of application, I didn't think to look for it. But they've become a really like good friend and collaborator, and it would have benefited me a lot more had I like done my research in my first year properly, of like going quite far away from just my little niche and really looking at broader things. And now I'm a lot better for it. And I think the fact that you have the archive email setup. Like, that's something I didn't realize you could do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good to just keep your like options open and also just read a load in your first year. And it, you know, it's never too late. I'm fine. But I think I would have served me a lot better had I actually listened to everyone older than me telling me not to be like them.
I know PhD students, the similar boat of not having done enough reading, and then when it comes to writing the first paper, being told by the supervisor, no, you need to go and do a lot more reading. Your introduction is not fleshed out enough.
Yeah.
There just isn't enough there because you haven't read enough. You don't know enough in this field to write a comprehensive enough introduction on this, which is an awful position to be in.
Yeah, it's a fixable problem, but it's something that if you can save yourself from having to deal with, can be quite nice. And especially, yeah, when you come to write your thesis and you have to give a comprehensive literature review of the field, and say where your research fits in. But I'd say that's sort of my main takeaway, is just like, always be curious, keep reading everything. There isn't one right way to read a paper. I see a lot of tips that are like, this will get you reading 10 papers a day, and it's like, no,
it won't.
Whatever works for you, however conventional or unconventional.
Okay, so we've talked at length about academic writing, so shall we divert away from the academia chat and talk a bit more about some fluids?
Yes.
And specifically, in this case, what actually counts as one? Because right after we finished filming and recording the last episode of the podcast, we were on Discord with some friends, and there was a whole discussion about what counts as a fluid versus a liquid. And before we get to the in-depth topic, I'm gonna ask you about a different potential fluid or potential liquid, which is that you maintain that mayo is not a liquid but is a fluid. Explain.
Okay. I didn't say it wasn't a liquid. I said it was more accurate to describe it as a fluid. It depends sort of where you're coming from, right? Like, if you talk to a material scientist, the distinction between sort of states of matter as we know them, as we're taught in school, is a bit more blurred than I think people kind of realize. Fluids then kind of sit above that because they don't fit into one nice neat category. I think you can agree with me that both like gas,
like,
and liquid,
like water counts as a fluid, but so does air.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. So fluids are things that flow. If I can describe, if the particles are sort of free to sort of move over each other, and it can flow and it can fit a container, like if I put a fluid in a container, it will kind of move and spread based on the forces that are acting on it to fill said space without airing or shearing or whatever.
Yeah.
I maintain a lot of things can be described as fluids that aren't as clear cut in liquids or gases. So I don't remember saying specifically the mayonnaise one, but mayonnaise is like a mixed compound.
I can give you the quote if it will help you. Somebody said that it's normally made from oil and corn syrup. Think liquid mayo. And I replied that saying, you're implying mayo isn't liquid, to which you said, fluid definitely, liquid questionable.
Yeah. So mayo is like, it's like eggs, right?
Yeah.
There's some oily stuff in there and some fatty stuff, and then there's some like liquidy stuff. Most of my argument, and actually this might give you a hint for why I enjoyed flummoxing you with the next bit, is non-Newtonian fluids have very different key properties to like a standard fluid.
Yeah.
So
non-Newtonian fluids being things like ketchup or custard.
Or mayonnaise,
okay.
Yeah. So they don't always necessarily behave as you would expect them to. So a non-Newtonian fluid is something that the viscosity of it, so how sticky it is to itself, changes when a force is applied or an external factor is applied. So you can think, if you try and pour ketchup, it doesn't come out, but if you shake it, it does, and it becomes more runny. And that's because you've applied a force that makes it runnier. So it's via thinning. Yeah. By a shear, it thins. Mayonnaise is similar to that, right? Like, it will separate out and be really like thick and stodgy, way more so than ketchup, right? Like, mayonnaise without any force applied to it is much more of a solid like thing than mayonnaise than ketchup is on its own. So mm-hmm. my argument was mostly just to be contrarian a little bit with mayonnaise. But I would argue between the sort of oil separating out from it and then what's left is just a very, very, very dense sheer thinning non-Newtonian fluid. I would say like it's not necessarily liquidy. It's more on the liquid side.
Okay.
But like you can definitely get mayonnaise that is so solid that if you just take a spoon and turn it upside down, it will stay there for like a good amount of time.
Okay.
Like yeah. a really good meringue.
I guess what we're saying then. yeah. Okay, I guess what we're saying then is really that mayo is sometimes liquid.
Mayo is sometimes liquid. If it's ever gaseous, then run away. But yeah.
Just gaseous mayo. No, that's not a good thing.
No.
Please do not inhale mayo. Now let's move on to the one that you posed to me that I still do not have a good answer to. You maintain that glass is a fluid?
So this one I actually do. Again, fluids are anything that can flow. And I'm okay. surprised that this is something that has kind of stumped you as hard as it had, because especially given how we work on different length scales, but we're both studying fluids yeah. that behave similar properties. Fluids can act on different time scales. If you heat glass, even a little bit, and leave it for a long enough time,
yeah,
it will flow.
How hot are you talking about?
So surprisingly, not that hot.
Because you get that sort of thing of if, like with most solids, if you heat them up enough, they will melt and they will flow.
Yes.
Like you can pour molten iron.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
An iron bar doesn't flow because it's a solid.
It's kind of, it sits in between, right? I don't think glass fits into your classic solid liquid gas model of materials. Because.
Explain.
Okay, so iron, or like a lot of metals. You're trying to make me remember chemistry.
I'm trying to remember chemistry, don't worry.
Metals and like solid, metals have a very like solid structure. Like it's very regimented, it's very organized, it's very like, the particles yes. are all lined up neatly and they fit, right? Glass in its like kind of natural state when it's really hot is a liquid. And then I would say that we have cooled it down and slowed the process of it flowing. Whereas like a solid, and I can hear people arguing with me in the comments telling me I'm not actually right with this, but this is how I perceive it. With something like iron, its kind of rest state is as a solid, and then we can heat it up and move it around.
You're sort of making the argument that basically that the molecules of glass can still move over each other and are doing so at a slow rate, even when we perceive it to be solid.
Yeah, so essentially the argument is that it's just a really, really, really slow-moving liquid. Things like wood, for example, are not slow-moving liquids. They're never going to deform out of shape.
Well, they'll deform out of shape, but not for yeah. that reason.
You can't melt wood.
No, but if everyone's seen a desk that then bows after it's had something sitting on it for too long.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm just picturing liquid tree.
That is what they're describing, the whole like boxes full of algae that they're suggesting putting in city centres.
What?
Okay, so in certain cities around the world where it is really hard to grow trees, but they want to do the whole like improve air quality thing, essentially oh. it's like boxes full of algae that do the whole like taking carbon dioxide, put out oxygen stuff, oh, and in the process cool. produce heat that is also used then for electricity generation.
Okay.
And they've been called liquid trees.
I love that. I love that so much. Yeah. But if you look at old stained glass windows, right?
Yeah.
So the glass was not super tempered, I think. It does kind of look a bit runny.
That's for the reason that the glass is flowing. I think that's just less refined manufacturing techniques.
Yeah. And then it's ever so slightly more runny than, like, on-day windows.
Essentially, what we're trying to say as we wrap up this episode of the podcast is that fluids are weird.
They're weird, they're funky, and if something is moving and in a flow-like manner, then I'm calling it a fluid.
Okay. That seems reasonable. Yeah. Okay, so I think this is probably a good place to leave it for this week. As always, you can reach out to us on the podcast on Instagram at Unstable Fluid Podcast, on the network formerly known as Twitter, now X, at Unstable Fluid, and via email at unstablefluidpodcast@gmail.com.
If you're listening to us on a Spotify thing, or if you're listening to us on a podcasty thing, you can find us on YouTube. And if you're watching us on YouTube, you can also find us on your podcasty thing. But it is just rinse and repeating, so do it that way.
They
will.
Are in the show notes or description, depending on what platform you are on. And if you'd like to discuss anything about the podcast with other listeners, then you'll also find a link there to a Discord server where there's a channel to discuss the podcast as well.
So I guess the only thing that's left to say is thank you so much for putting up with us for the last amount of time. And we can't wait to see you in the next one. Or not see you.
Or hear you. Wait, no, not hear you. Ah, we did this again!